This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Day 93 of the U.S.-Israeli genocide against Palestinians. Two more journalists are killed, raising the death toll among the press corps to 109. Palestinian resistance fighters kill more invading Israeli soldiers and destroy some of their weapons, retaliation for the ongoing onslaught on Gaza. And Palestine's resistance group of Jenin Brigade ambushes Israeli occupation forces, killing at least one Israeli trooper and injuring several others. Thanks for joining us. Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip continue unabated, leaving behind more casualties every day. The latest Israeli attacks on central Gaza claimed over 40 lives. 11 of those were killed in strikes on a home and a school in Palestinian refugee camp in the city of Deir al-Bala. Another 20 lost their lives in Israeli raids on the Jabalia refugee camp in the north. That brings to at least 180 the total number of Palestinians killed in Israeli strikes on the coastal sliver over the past 24 hours. Over 22,700 Palestinians have been killed since Israel began its onslaught on Gaza on October 7. The Israeli military campaign against civilians in Gaza has drawn worldwide condemnation, with most countries and international bodies calling for an immediate end to the genocide. At least two more journalists have been killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. Mustafa Turaya and Hamza Dahdu died when a missile directly hit their vehicle west of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Hamza was the son of Palestinian journalist Wal Dahdu, who has already lost his wife, daughter, other son, and grandson to Israeli airstrikes. Last month, Wal himself was wounded in an Israeli strike that also killed his colleague. The latest fatalities bring to 109 the number of journalists killed in Gaza since October 7. Palestinians say the Israeli army deliberately targets journalists to hide the truth about the situation in Gaza and the regime's atrocities. Palestinian resistance fighters have targeted Israeli forces with heavy shelling after they raided the Al-Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza. The retaliatory attacks were launched by Qassam Brigades, which is the military wing of Hamas resistance movement. One Israeli armored personnel carrier was destroyed by the resistance fighters. Earlier, Qassam also killed eight Israeli forces in an ambush in Bani Sahela, east of Khan Yunis. The group says it also destroyed two Merkava tanks in a separate operation against Israeli forces in the Al-Bawraj refugee camp. Israel says more than 170 of its troopers have been killed in the Gaza Strip since the regime began its ground invasion of the Palestinian territory on October 27. Resistance groups, however, say the regime is underreporting its casualties. Israel has launched a new air raid on the West Bank city of Jenin, killing at least six Palestinians. Palestinians say the attack was carried out by a drone. The strike came after an Israeli military vehicle was hit by an explosive device in Jenin. One Israeli soldier was killed and three others were injured. The Jenin Brigade resistance group has released the footage showing the moment of the explosion. It says the number of the Israeli fatalities is higher than the figure announced by the regime. Israel has stepped up its deadly crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territory since October the 7th. Since then, hundreds of Palestinians have been killed and over 4,000 others abducted in the occupied West Bank. Our correspondent Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us for more details about the Israeli attack on Jenin.
New airstrike has been carried out against a group of Palestinians in an area called the Martyrs Triangle in Jenin. And this airstrike led to the killing of 6 Palestinians. 4 of them are Palestinian brothers. And the 2 more others who had been killed were also the cousins of the 4 brothers who had been killed. We are speaking about 6 Palestinian civilians. Palestinians know that there is an Israeli military of military raid of Jenin and its refugee camp. And we are speaking about an overcrowded area. So people left their homes in order to check what's going on. And then an Israeli airstrike carried out this Israeli, of course, airstrike was carried out against the group of Palestinians.
A group of 30 associations and parties in Kuwait have called on the country's government to join the lawsuit filed by South Africa against Israel at the International Court of Justice. The group issued a statement denouncing international silence toward Israeli crimes in the Gaza Strip. The signatories said the regime's actions constitute war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. South Africa's lawsuit says the magnitude of death and destruction in the Gaza Strip meets the definition of genocide in international law. Meanwhile, nearly 100 Chilean lawyers have filed a case against the Israeli Prime Minister at the International Criminal Court. The lawsuit calls for an arrest warrant against Benjamin Netanyahu and a number of other Israeli officials for committing crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes in Gaza. Fahar Hasham joins us from Kuwait City, a correspondent, to tell us more about what has occurred there. So Fahar, tell us more about these this group that has decided to go ahead and file this lawsuit. What type of lawsuit and the crimes that they have introduced, I guess, in their file?
First of all, hello, and thank you for having me. I would like to stress on the fact that these 30 civic groups that also represent Kuwait University, Kuwait People Against Normalization with Israel, Kuwait Supporting Palestine, they are not working just alone, independently. They are following the recommendations that were signed and approved by the Kuwaiti Parliament last month, before the death of His Highness the Sheikh Nawaf al-Ahmad al-Sabah. And since Kuwait is in mourning, nothing has been happening here because everybody is devastated by the death and also by the fact that Kuwait has entered a state of mourning since the beginning of the 7 October attacks and the genocide that has been taking place in Gaza. So I do believe that Kuwait is working on that. And in the first parliament, last month, they set a set of recommendations. And these recommendations include to adopt a list to refer Netanyahu to international court for committing genocide against Palestinians, for committing crimes, for violating the rules and regulations of human rights in the United Nations, and they already adopted them and approved by the previous government. Currently, after the death of Sheikh Nawaf al-Ahmad, his Highness Sheikh Mish'al al-Sabah has been appointed as the Prince of Kuwait, and currently he has given the responsibility. He assigned the Prime Minister to be Sheikh Mohammed Salim al-Sabah. And we are now currently shuffling ministers and shuffling cabinets, trying to form a new government. And as soon as this government is formed, this is going to be on the top of the agenda in Kuwait.
All right. I do have more questions. If you don't mind staying with us, let me see if we have our other guests here. Barry Grossman, international lawyer. Barry Grossman, welcome. So walk us through the difference that exists between the ICC and the ICJ in terms of what they target, and then the efficiency of both organizations when it comes to their targets, whether this is really realistic in nature. Of course, we've seen the momentum gather here from South Africa to the Kuwaiti, I guess, groups, and also from Chile, where you also have lawyers there who have gone the ICC route.
Yeah, well, in a nutshell, the ICJ is a creature of the United Nations. Its jurisdiction is limited to cases brought against states rather than against individuals. and that has been brought by another member state, whereas the ICC has no jurisdiction to make ruling against any state, has jurisdiction to make rulings against individuals that are proven to have committed war crimes, if the two countries involved have acceded to the Rome Statutes. So it gets a bit complicated, but I think it's worth pointing out that the differences are sort of melting away since the current prosecutor at the ICC has made it very clear that he intends to prioritize cases referred to the ICC by the Security Council. And for Jay itself, vote to make ruling the Security Council and ultimately relies on the Security Council. But it is more than symbolic that these complaints are coming forward. And of course, the silence of other Arab countries is something that's very difficult to comprehend. And those people in Kuwait who petitioned their own government to join these actions have pointed that out. I mean, they pointed out that they're astounded by the world silence and even more astounded by the complete failure of other Arab states to express themselves in any way that can be seen as a criticism of the occupying force.
I don't know if you recall, you had Zippy Livni a while back. It was Operation Cast Lead, and she was a threat of being arrested if she were to go to London, and she was she had planned a trip to go there. My question is whether any of these two courts can actually work with the local governments in order to carry through, for example, an arrest warrant or even anything that's related to sentencing or being accused. Does it work that way at all?
Any powers of arrest or anything else? I suppose an arrest warrant could be issued, but it seems very unlikely that they would issue an arrest warrant for head of state until a case has been made and proven. And whether that actually will happen remains to be seen. I certainly have a lot of doubts. I mean, I was listening to an interview with a former prosecutor at the ICJ only yesterday talking about genocide, and he wasn't speaking about Israeli. He wasn't speaking about a genocide being perpetrated by the occupation forces. He was speaking about how, in his view, it was Hamas that was guilty of committing genocide as a result of the action they took, supposedly, on the 7th of October. In other words, the deck is completely stacked. And ultimately, the position that the ICJ is willing to take is determined by the Security Council. So it's not even really a judicial body in many ways. The ICJ will almost never make findings that conflict with the stated position of the Security Council. And the ICC now, after listening to threats for years from both America and the occupation and Israel about destroying the ICC, now has a prosecutor who is basically a Zionist. So, like I said, I there's really not scope for that kind of an outcome, in my opinion. But,
okay,
you know, it still does not mean that these cases are useless. Ultimately, it generates people power. People power translates to pressure on governments around the world, at the polls, and eventually something has to give. But right now, it's become completely absurd in Gaza. I mean, we've got the occupation now debating openly getting rid of Netanyahu, not because of what he's done, not out of criticism of that, but because he doesn't want to say that at this point that all all Palestinians will be thrown out of Gaza to make room for Israeli settlers.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Barry Grossman there, international lawyer from Bali, Indonesia. Thank you. Moving on, tensions remain high along Lebanon's southern border, where an Israeli airbase has been targeted by Hezbollah resistance movements. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, tells us more about the significance of the latest attack and the importance of the base and gives us details of the attack.
They said that this is the highest peak in all of occupied Palestine, but it is also the only airbase in northern occupied Palestine, Palestine in the northern area. It is on the mountain of Jarmuk, and that mountain is considered, of course, the highest peak. And at the same time, this is an airbase. This is where they control the movements, where there is surveillance, air control. And this is the only headquarters also in the north where you have the Israeli control and monitoring and orchestration of the airstrikes and any air movement that goes towards Lebanon, Cyprus, Turkey, and Iraq, and Syria, of course. This is very significant. So that in itself seems to be another way to avenge the airstrikes that are taking place against Syria itself, since that is where they basically come out from. All of the air strikes that go against Syria, they begin in that base specifically. And now, in addition to the fact that this is a very significant headquarters, if you take a look at the statement of Hezbollah also, they said that this is a preliminary retaliation for the assassination of the Hamas leader, Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri. They did not mention the strike against the southern suburbs of Beirut. They did not mention that this is a retaliation for the Israeli violation of Lebanese sovereignty. And so that perhaps is in itself going to be left for another time.
Yemen has pledged to continue to block the passage of all Israeli-owned and Israeli-bound ships through the Red Sea, in response to the regime's genocide in the Gaza Strip.
These developments and the painful developments that are taking place in Palestine led us to take such measures. The Quran has authorized us to defend the oppressed. Every kind of ship linked to the Zionist regime or partially or entirely owned by the regime will not pass through the Red Sea, no matter what the costs, and we will stick with this decision at any cost.
The head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says the country will not stop its operations until Israel ends its onslaught and siege on the Gaza Strip. Mahdi al-Mashat says this is meant for peace. Mashat also says Yemenis are committed to protecting their brothers in Gaza and are ready for all possibilities. He warned that all options are available to the Yemeni army. His comments came after the U.S. warned Yemen of consequences if it does not stop the attacks. The Yemeni armed forces have launched missile and drone attacks on vessels operated by Israel or heading to its ports in solidarity with Gazans for several weeks. Meanwhile, protests against Israel's genocidal war in Gaza are growing bolder. In the United States, the busiest street in the nation's third largest city was shut down for hours and right outside the residence of a top Democratic Party senator. Rami Mazzari has more.
Illinois Senator Dick Durbin has been called the oldest friend in Congress of AIPAC, the influential pro-Zionist lobbying committee. Protesters gathered outside his home to demand that the second highest ranking Democratic senator stop supporting Israel's latest war on Gaza. But then activists grew tired of being ignored. Protesters crossed from Senator Durbin's high-class residence onto historic Lakeshore Drive along Lake Michigan. Traffic is shut down in both directions on the most important road in the city in a rare and powerful example of local political activism. Protesters told angry motorists that the person they should be blaming was Senator Durbin.
Senator Dick Durbin actually represents the biggest Palestinian constituent population in the United States. He has a duty to be on the front lines of calling for a ceasefire in Gaza.
When police refused to release one of two activists arrested Protesters refused to move for hours.
This is not a religious issue. It's not a political issue. It's a humanitarian crisis. It's an issue that is affecting everybody in the world, or most people, and everybody wants a resolution. So we hope for a peaceful resolution. That's why we're out here.
The Arab population in the United States is about half of the Jewish population, but Arab influence in American politics and culture is relatively non-existent. For over two decades, open discrimination has been constant, as are hypocritical double standards.
I was in Palestine on October 7th. So I've lived my whole life in America. I lived in Palestine for 4 years, but we came here and I grew up here. I was raised here. But I feel like my identity as an American is shattered anytime something happens. And I see that that my American colleagues and classmates and friends all of a sudden turn a blind eye when it comes to Palestinian life. And it's very disappointing. And it's especially when you come back and you see that your own tax dollars are being put towards this genocide.
Since October 7th, public opinion has shifted massively against Israel, especially among young voters. That may embolden activists to try even more attention-demanding protests against Israel's atrocities and murder in Palestine. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Let's bye-bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. Deep, sincere faith, strong, firm determination, the intelligence of the Iranian youth, the ability of military and non-military elements to use initiative and innovation, and the ability to overcome global aggressors were the things that were revealed and seen about our nation and our soldiers during the Sacred Defense. Another achievement of the Sacred Defense was that it expanded our frontiers. I am not speaking of geographical borders. We did not seek to expand our geographical borders neither at that time nor now. We are not seeking to expand our geographical borders. The sacred defense expanded our other frontiers, such as the frontier of resistance. This is an example. Today, the concept of resistance and the element of resistance is an established element. There's resistance in Palestine. There is resistance in West Asia, and there is resistance in various other countries. There is resistance in Iraq, there is resistance in Iran, and in various places.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The sacred defense raised and promoted the idea of resistance around the world. It established resistance in many parts of the world. We ourselves may find it hard to believe that the actions of the Iranian nation have had such an impact in distant countries, but they have had such an impact. We have information about this. I do not wish to name the countries. A large number of the Iranian nation's activities have served as a model for many people in the East, in Asia, in Africa, and also in Latin America. This is what expanding frontiers means. Our intellectual and cognitive borders have expanded. This is a nation's greatest success to be able to expand its own culture, understanding, knowledge, and wishes in the world. This mainly took place by way of the sacred defense. The 8 years of the sacred defense worked miracles in this aspect. It spread the culture of self-reliance. Now, when we speak about resistance, we want to see whom this resistance is standing against.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me. Through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On January the 3rd, 2024, twin terrorist explosions hit an event in the Iranian city of Kerman, marking the fourth anniversary of the assassination of senior Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The two explosions occurred minutes apart at two different locations packed with civilians. Some of the injured recount the horror that they've been through.
I think it was 3 o'clock when the explosion happened. People were running toward me. I saw several injured lying on the ground. I was scared. It was very awful. The air was dusty. I really don't want to remember that moment again.
There was an explosion that caused a commotion, and suddenly there was a second blast that made people more afraid. Shrapnel could be seen, and people were falling on each other. I can't describe. I can only say that it was a terrible moment.
The terrorist attacks have drawn strong condemnation from Iran, other countries, and international bodies, including the United Nations. The Security Council has called it a reprehensible act whose perpetrators should be held to account. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has vowed those behind the cowardly terrorist bombings cannot get away with their crime.
This flood of people that poured towards the grave of Haj Qasem these days, you come to scare the people within your criminal act. You're not strong enough to face the resistance. Your power has lost its effectiveness against the forces of resistance. Now you're targeting innocent people? Know that you will pay a heavy price for this horrible crime.
Meanwhile, the drama took a new twist when the Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the bombings. Some experts argued that the terrorist attacks bore all the hallmarks of an Israeli operation rather than one by Daesh.
Whoever is behind it, and I think we can assume who that is, that this has the United States and Israel written all over it.
Some Iranian media also cast doubt over Daesh being behind the attacks, as the terrorist group has a different modus operandi. These media believe the Daesh statement was in fact drawn up by the Israeli regime. They say this proves Israel is really scared of the consequences of its criminal act and that Daesh is a tool in the hands of the Tel Aviv regime. But whoever behind the deadly terrorist act, one thing is certain. And that is, the terrorists have failed to achieve their objectives by killing innocent civilians.
Qasem Soleimani was born on March 11, 1957, in the province of Kirman, situated in the south of the Islamic Republic of Iran. At the age of 13, the young Qasem left school and began working on a construction site in a different town to help support his family financially. Over the course of the next decade, he also took part in revolutionary activities against the regime of the Shah. In 1979, when Imam Ruhollah Khomeini led the Islamic Revolution to victory, Haj Qasem joined the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Despite minimal training, he showed great talent and natural aptitude and rose up the ranks quickly. The following year, in 1980, when Saddam's Iraqi army invaded Iran, a 23-year-old Qasem joined the battle, and as a company leader, he trained and led a group of volunteers from his home district of Kirman into battle. In a quote attributed to Haj Qasem, he says, "I entered the Iran-Iraq war on a 15-day mission and ended up staying until the end." He fought in multiple battles over the course of the war, receiving serious injuries in the Battle of Tariq al-Quds, close to the border with Iraq. After the end of the war, he was deployed in Kirman province, his area of birth, where he garnered a reputation as a formidable combatant against rampant drug smuggling in the region. In the late 90s, he was appointed as the head of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a unit dedicated to liberating al-Quds, and spent the following years building up the organization's capabilities and relationships across the region. It was in this role as leader of the Quds Force that he assisted Lebanon in firstly expelling the Israeli occupation in the year 2000, and then in defeating them again during the July War of 2006. But perhaps his greatest victory was in being the person most responsible for the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group, who had taken over huge swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq in 2014. His leadership on the battlefield and his subsequent support for groups trying to expel occupying American forces from West Asia cemented him as a legend amongst the people of the region, while also putting him square in the crosshairs of the mass-murdering U.S. empire and its local lackeys.
December is the time of year that Christians worldwide celebrate the birth of the Messiah, Jesus, may peace and blessings be upon him. Celebrations in Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus, are considered holy because the passion and resurrection of Jesus happened inside the city's walls. Bethlehem is a Palestinian city in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, surrounded today by a massive concrete wall, military checkpoints, and illegal settlements.
It's imposing a system of control that I'm sure Jesus was very familiar of. If he's born today, he would be born on our side of the wall.
According to the Gospels, the most important features of Christianity have their origins in Jerusalem. The institution of the Eucharist took place while Jesus was celebrating Passover with his disciples in Jerusalem. Also, his crucifixion at the Golgotha, where Jesus remained calm, compassionate, and loving even in the face of death. And according to Christian belief, his resurrection 3 days later all happened in Jerusalem. In this way, Jerusalem constitutes a unique and holy city for Christianity. Other holy sites are associated with events from the Old Testament, the lives of Mary, John the Baptist, and the apostles, with endless more associated with later Christian saints, holy men and women, and local traditions. But Bethlehem will be a somber place this year, as the Christian of the three major churches, Greek Orthodox, Armenian, and Catholic, have stated they will not be celebrating.
This year is going to be totally different. There won't be any lights. We will not have the Christmas tree. We will be mourning those who are being slaughtered in Gaza. There's a deep atmosphere of grief here, and all the churches have decided to only have religious services for Christmas.
These holy places, the indigenous Christian community and pilgrims who come to visit from all over the world, have long been the subject of violence, harassment, and intimidation by the occupation forces who have not allowed the community to worship in peace. The Temple Mount is no exception, often the subject of brutality despite being considered a holy place. It is where Jesus was first presented as an infant to the temple and its people by his holy mother Mariam. It was also there where he famously taught elders of the community at the tender age of 13 and later threw out the money changers from the same temple grounds. Unfortunately, the percentage of Christians living in Bethlehem and in other occupied Palestinian territories has plummeted. With the community currently totaling under 2% of the population, the fear that Christians will one day no longer have a presence in Palestine is slowly becoming a reality. The reason is extremely clear for the indigenous worshipers.
The World Health Organization has once again sounded the alarm on deepening humanitarian and medical crisis in war-torn Gaza. It has called on the international community to take urgent steps to alleviate the grave peril facing Palestinians in the besieged territory. According to the latest WHO assessments, Gaza has 13 partially functioning hospitals, 2 minimally functioning ones, and 21 that are not functioning at all.
There are actually no functional hospitals left in the north. Al-Ahli was the last one, but is now minimal functional. Still treating patients but not admitting new ones, along with Al-Shifa, Al-Ada, and Al-Sahaba Hospital. So these hospitals are still sheltering also thousands of displaced people. At Al-Ahli, about 10 staff, all junior doctors and nurses, continue to provide basic first aid, pain management, as much as possible, wound care, and trauma stabilization services.
The Nasser Medical Complex, which is the most important referral hospital in southern Gaza, is partially functioning. The world body has expressed concern about reports of residential areas being ordered to evacuate around the hospital, which are extremely concerning. According to WHO reports and eyewitness accounts, when military activities intensify near the hospital, ambulances, patients, staff, and WHO and partners are unable to reach the complex. The World Body has also said that it is working to strengthen and expand the existing struggling health system.
WHO will keep striving to supply health facilities in the north of Gaza, but without fuel, staff, and other essential needs medicines, it won't make, medicines won't make a difference, and all patients will die slowly and painfully.
It has also expressed concern about the fresh wave of displacement of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, who have been pushed by Israel to move to further south. It says the displacement of people will further strain health facilities in the south, which are already struggling to meet the population's immense needs. The WHO statement read, "This forced mass movement of people will also lead to more overcrowding, increased risk of infectious diseases, and make it even harder to deliver humanitarian aid. Most of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are grappling with terrible injuries, acute hunger, and severe risk of disease." WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom has also repeated a call on the international community to, quote, take urgent steps to alleviate the grave peril facing the population of Gaza. The remarks come a day after the WHO staff went on a high-risk mission to deliver humanitarian supplies to the Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza and Al-Amal Palestine Red Crescent Society in southern Gaza. Both hospitals serve as shelters for displaced Palestinians seeking safety amid relentless Israeli bombardment. At Al-Shifa Hospital, a reported 50,000 people are sheltering, while 14,000 others are at Al-Amal.
Seen children, women, young men, old men and women, people bleeding out. I, at the same time yesterday at Al-Aqsa, I saw a woman who had multiple gunshot wounds. An attempt was made to refer her, and she was referred back because she was bleeding so heavily. So, I mean, there's blood everywhere in these hospitals at the moment. We're seeing almost only trauma cases come through the door, and at a scale that's quite difficult to believe. It's a bloodbath, as we said before. It's carnage.
They have been injured and have been in the hospital for 10 days. As soon as the Israeli troops withdrew, I rushed to take them. As you can see, they suffer from total burns for no reason. They were left with no food or water and no care. There are other injured members of my family, but I wasn't able to carry them. After I arrived at the hospital, I witnessed massive destruction, an indescribable scene. Patients are scattered in every corner, beds are overturned, and medical material are damaged.
Comments come as Israel is pressing ahead with its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. From corpses lying unattended on the streets, to hospitals and schools reduced to rubble, to children made orphans and tens of thousands of people rendered homeless, the gory events unfolding in the besieged Gaza Strip since October 7 are a textbook example of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The death toll in the coastal territory since the Israeli regime launched its indiscriminate aerial and ground attacks nearly 3 months ago is now over 21,000, most of them children and women. Almost all refugee camps have been rendered uninhabitable due to random strikes, forcing the majority of the population to sleep under the open sky amid heavy winds and heavy downpours. The barbaric attacks were only meant to give an image of victory to its defeated army, which has only succeeded in killing unarmed civilians and destroying civilian facilities.
This is really the worst thing that U.S. and Israel could do to Palestinians. The genocide is the heinous war crimes are gone unnoticed.
Zionist Israeli entity intensified its aggression on Gaza while keeping one eye on Hezbollah in Lebanon and the other on the West Bank, primarily due to its strategic proximity. Neither the entity nor the United States of America foresaw that Yemen, which has been at war for years without a practical resolution, would turn into a new front. In November, the Yemeni armed forces declared war on the Zionist entity in support of the resistance in Gaza, presenting a significant and unwelcome surprise for the entity. Yemen initiated missile and drone attacks on targets in the Zionist Israeli port of Eilat, overlooking the Red Sea. However, the Yemeni armed forces did not stop there and announced the imposition of what could be described as a naval blockade on the entity. It appears that there are significant losses due to the Yemeni missiles, prompting the Pentagon in the first week of December to announce a plan to form a naval force to so-called protect international navigation in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and the Red Sea. However, despite the availability of European countries' warships and frigates, they do not express great enthusiasm to join this force. Well, that is mainly due to the fact that European countries do not possess a large naval fleet. Warships are distributed between protecting the coasts of these countries and positioning near Ukraine in anticipation of any developments in the Russian-Ukrainian war. On the other hand, these countries are concerned that if they participate in confronting the Yemeni armed forces in their Gaza support operations, their commercial ships passing through the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea could themselves become targets for the Yemenis. In the meantime, despite the Pentagon's threat to respond to the Yemenis, the Yemeni armed forces daily reaffirm their determination to continue targeting Israeli entity ships and ships bound towards occupied Palestine until the Zionist entity ends the genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The matter is no longer limited to imposing a blockade on Zionist Israeli ports. The geostrategic battle and its escalating events are shaking the world. The closure of the Red Sea to ships colluding with the enemy turns into a heroic festival, teaching the U.S. and Zionist Israel harsh lessons and threatening them with more successive blows capable of breaking their alliances and coercive global policies. These strikes establish a new stage of resistance given the expansion of its military operations and the development of its capabilities to combat malicious international hegemony. There is a clear evolution in the history of resistance post-October 7 and after the introduction of the equation of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Start. Movement. Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam my deen. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back. Yes, this is
Your Station here.
I'm Asma.
And I am Vita.
Yes, and I think we're going to have a beautiful session today.
I do agree with that.
How are you, Vita?
I'm doing well. Yeah. You know, it goes as usual.
Life is moving on and on. Just as we were coming to here, I had a little bit of problem. And then I started thinking about, okay, why life doesn't get any easier?
You know, life is not supposed to be easy.
Every day you have a new story.
Yeah.
Every day a new problem. And every day you have to get ready of how to cope with new situations.
I do agree with that. You know, life is an ocean of difficulties, obstacles, examinations, and so many other things that we have to deal with, unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm not sure even about it. And, you know, it always reminds me of this verse of Holy Quran, that لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدْ, or we truly created mankind in difficulty.
Exactly.
So difficulty is a part of our destiny, is a part of what we have our to struggle with.
Yeah.
Exactly. And if you hope for, I don't know, living easily. No, there is nothing.
Oh, that's impossible. Yeah, we never wish impossible. For that. But then, you know.
We wish for that because it's a part of our nature to want this ease.
Okay, then that's lying to yourself. If you think there would ever come a day in which there is no problem and in which there is no...
It's a big lie.
Yeah, it's a big lie because there was a great religious scholar to whom I was just listening, and through his lecture, he was just saying that if there came a night at which you just put your head on the pillow without thinking about anything and you felt like, okay, what a peaceful life, what a wonderful life I am, and there's nothing to worry about, then make sure that night is the last night of your life.
Exactly. It happens to me a lot. The times that I feel like, okay, this is the life that I always wanted to have, like empty of any problems or difficulty. And then the day after, I will face a really, really difficult problem in my life.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. If you think, okay, that's... But you have nothing to worry about, then probably that's the end of your life.
Yeah.
Because usually to me, it's like this. That when I think everything is okay, right after that moment when I'm thinking that everything is okay, something gets into my mind and I figure out that no, it's not okay.
Yeah, your life is always a standard or reminding you that no, I'm not easy, as easy as you think. So
yeah, but just like right now.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have to interrupt you because we have a break
and
we have to go for it.
If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir.
Oh, welcome back. Yes, this is Youth Station. Still, you're listening to us. Bita and I are in here talking about life and its difficulties. And by the way, something got into my mind.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading somewhere something about a person who was talking about their life. And then he was saying that it's not that we get stronger. It's just that we get used to everything. And then I started to think, okay, is he right? Do we really get used to things, or is that we get stronger?
Yeah, this is something I, most of the time I think about it, that it's a matter of getting stronger, or the matter of the problem is being just, you know,
too
something
much repeated to me.
Yeah. And, but the point is, a mixture of these two together, a combination of these two together will be the answer. You know, you get stronger when you deal with so many problems, and you know, even getting used to problems is a way of getting stronger. So you cannot just tell me that, no, I'm getting used to that. There is no difference about my abilities and capabilities.
Well, you know, I guess it depends on your definition of strength.
Strength.
How do you define being strong? Well, as for me, I would say a strength means that, for example, when there comes a problem for the first time, I do not know how to deal with it. But the next time when I face it, it's going to be as easy as a pie for me because I have already went through too much of strategies and too much of techniques. And right now I'm much more prepared to face it.
Yeah, like this. Strength is when you have to control over the situations that you're facing.
Yeah.
And this control is equal to your strength. And you know, the times that you're struggling with problems, the more you understand the problems, the more you get to know those problems, you will have the control over them. And this will lead you to a state of being stronger.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is the way I look at it.
If I face too many problems, at the end of the day, I'm going to be in a stronger person.
I have to tell you that there are times that you feel like you're weak. You're not strong enough to defeat this problem. You're not strong enough to fight.
Well,
and this is a kind of form of strength itself. When you come to realize that you're not strong enough.
Yeah. You mentioned something very important. The urge to fight is the strength, I suppose.
I was reading a beautiful sentence somewhere that every problem has a kind of specific period that have to be passed.
Yeah.
And you have to wait. You have to be patient. And sometimes this patience is the key to your strength.
Exactly. But, you know, as just you said, when the duration gets to be longer, then you might change. And for I'm sure not sure that for all the cases you're going to be stronger than when you started.
Yeah,
sometimes you're going to turn into a totally different person. Well, there have been too much of stories and too many real stories that we've seen around us among our friends or relatives, people that we know, the circles that we have been involved in. Many of them, they have been good people. But then they get into a trouble, a problem that gets going for too long. Then what happens is that when you see them after a year or 2 years, you see a totally different person.
You know what? I think at the first step, we have to realize the meaning of all these hardships that we're facing in life. When you have a kind of correct and proper perspective on these issues, you can solve them better than any other one that doesn't have any kind of clue about why I'm living here, why I'm going through this pain of living. I don't want to leave, okay? Mm-hmm. So why did you give me something so miserable at the first step? So you have to find the answer to this question the first step. Then,
The answers are too important.
Yeah, they are too important.
The purpose of life is going to direct your life.
Exactly.
Well, you know, just speaking of difficulties make us stronger, I do remember the story of the drop of water that was getting into a stone. And then just
story.
As was as it went on for too long, the thing that happened was that even that a stone got cut from that drop of water. If you take care of what happens around you, then I think you're going to grow up. And it's not a slogan, because by now we have already been mature enough to understand what a problem is, what a difficulty is. So we're not people coming from another planet and talking about a utopia. No, it's not like that. We are human beings, and we know what does it mean to go through drudgery, to go through misery. We all have been there and done that. So I guess it's the best time for us to go for a break.
Oh.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear listeners. So we're here again at U Station talking about...
Talking about difficulties making us stronger.
Yeah.
Do we really get stronger? Well, that's a question I guess it would differ. The answer to that question is going to differ from one person to another.
And one situation to another.
Yeah, of course. One situation to another.
So,
because sometimes you have no idea of the pressures that people are taking in their life. And then we start judging them about the range of difficulties they are suffering from.
Exactly. And the thing that we have to take into consideration is that sometimes we see some people are miserable, they feel bad, depressed, and so on. And when we ask, for example, what is wrong with you? The answer is something really easy, something really, you know, tiny.
Yeah.
And we feel like, oh my gosh, are you depressed over something like that?
Yeah.
And this question is the most judgmental question I've ever heard, because you don't read the story of that person, okay? Everyone.
Plus, there are some people who cannot convey their meaning perfectly. Maybe they're suffering too much, but they're saying a tad of it, tinge of it.
Another thing which is really important is that whatever you face through life, what difficulty you are dealing with, is according to your capacity and your potential ability that you have.
Exactly.
Okay, so the burden which is on your shoulder is to the strength of your shoulder. So you have to keep that in mind that, for example, if the exams that you're going through is more difficult than, for example, your friend, your neighbor, your family, or relative, then it's something good.
Then
it's a good
wrong,
news.
I suppose. If you're judging other people based on their sufferings, then you're wrong because you're not in their place. You know, there's a story. They say when we die and when the day of judgment is coming. Yeah. And that day, there is a tree on which people are going to just hang on their problems and difficulties in their life. The sort of suffering they have been through, it's going to be symbolized in sort of a thing. And then that thing is going to be hang on a tree. And then the thing that happens is something very interesting. Everybody is going to say, whatever I had was so good.
Nice.
Compared to other people. So that was enough for me. The thing that I was suffering was already suitable for me. I don't want to have any of other people's problems.
And this is the nature of human being. I think we always think like that. So,
but we don't get to the very depth of the stories.
Yeah.
And there's something, Bita, when we talk of a strength, I usually think a strength must have some manifestations. There must be some signs for me getting stronger. And to me, myself, I would call it this way. Patience is one of those signs.
For sure. Patience is the key to the question that you mentioned. Another thing is the times that you realize that you have to work on yourself. You have to take your time thinking and, you know, going through a journey to know more about yourself.
Yeah, to gain more.
Yeah, and to gain more. And this time is a revolutionary time for everyone, every individual in this world, to reach that level of self-development,
exactly,
you know, and a strength that we were talking about. And, you know, because there are some people that they talk to each other, oh, I have this problem, I have that problem, and I'm
nagging and all
nagging.
The stories.
No, it's not a sign of a strength.
Exactly. Yeah. You know? Those people who have gone through that